This is the Committee on Health and Human Services.
Thank you very much.
This is the Committee on Health and Human Services and Housing. It is, about 12:13 on Monday, March 11th, 2013. We're calling the meeting to order, and we do have a quorum. Senator Pappas. Senator Pappas is presenting Senate File 778. And as you're coming to the table, Senator Pappas, I just would like everybody here to know that this is the Health and Human Services Committee and that our focus today is on those issues in this bill that are related to health and human services. We are limiting our conversation and our testimony to those issues. And we have established the hearing today, invited persons who have requested to testify, 20 minutes total on the child care provider sections of the child care providers representation, and 20 minutes on the PCA long-term caregivers. And there'll be 10 minutes of testimony in favor and 10 in favor and 10 against in each of those sections following Senator Pappas' presentation of the bill. And then just for your information, the components of the bill that are under our jurisdiction are on page 1, subdivision 4, which is the definition for family child care worker. Under on page 2, subdivision 4, the compilation, and subdivision 3 and 4 on the commissioner's responsibilities for developing a list. And Article 2, which is the Article 2, Section 2, which is the quality self-directed services workforce. So those are the components of the bill that are under the jurisdiction of this committee. I know that this is a subject that has many components to it. I know that, Senator Pappas, you have had a hearing in your own committee that dealt with many of the other issues that are in this bill, a couple of days that you took testimony. And so I'm satisfied that it's important that we use our committee time to focus on those things that are within our jurisdiction. Yeah. So with that, Senator Pappas, would you please present your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll just make some brief opening comments so that we be sure we stay within the timeline. Madam Chair and members, the legislation introduced in Section 1 would authorize family child care providers to collectively bargain with the state of Minnesota on issues of mutual concern. This affects licensed and unlicensed providers who receive state subsidies only. Only those who receive state subsidies from the Child Care Assistance Program, and there are currently about 9,000 of these providers in Minnesota. Family child care providers are much more than babysitters. They deserve respect for doing one of the toughest and most important jobs imaginable, helping raise our children. They're professionals who are experienced, smart, dedicated, and loving. Nearly all family providers are women. Half have more than 10 years of experience. A quarter have more than 20 years experience. 22% have a bachelor's degree. More than half use a formal learning curriculum in their home-based program. On average, they are open 11 hours a day, on average, 5 days a week, 50 weeks a year. Some care for children on weekends and at night. They're paid less than minimum wage, about $4.95 an hour in the metro area, and about $2.83 an hour in greater Minnesota, according to the Department of Human Services. Family child care providers work alone in their homes. They're often isolated from peers who do the same work, face the same challenges, and have the same aspirations for their businesses and their profession. 16 states have already given providers the legal right to bargain collectively and have a voice in decisions that affect their work. These child care providers have helped other states improve training, provide more consistent care with less turnover, increase quality and affordability for parents, and ensure on-time payments for providers. Madam Chair, that is all I'm going to say about the child care section of the bill. And should I bring up my testifiers now before I talk about Section 2?
That might work. Why don't we stick with one section?
Stick with one section, and then we'll go to Section 2.
That's a good idea.
Okay, then the testifiers for the child care section should join me up here.
Did you want to adopt your amendment at this time, Senator Pappas?
I think the amendment's for Section 2. Is it? No. Madam Chair, we could adopt my amendment. It is, yes. These are suggested changes from Health and Human Services.
Okay, thank you.
The A3.
Senator Marty offers the A33 amendment to Senate File 778. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Oh, excuse me, Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, could we have Senator Pappas explain what this amendment does? I'm trying to go through statute and understand what the amendment does.
Senator Pappas?
Madam Chair, maybe Senate Counsel could do that for us, because I just received the amendment and I was told they were from DHS and that it was technical. So,
is there someone here from? Okay, thank you, Chair.
Madam Chair and members, I will try. Lines 1.2 to 1.4 clarifies what types of providers fall under the definition of family child care provider. Lines 1.5 to 1.7 clarifies which child care providers would be on the list determining certification.
Madam Chair, is she just describing the amendment? That's not what I have for the amendment, A33. It starts on page 2.
The amendment that we have starts on page 1.
That's correct. I'm referencing the lines on the actual amendment.
I see. I'm sorry. I apologize. Okay.
And then line 1.8 on the amendment just clarifies that it's the Commissioner of Human Services. It's on page 2, line 21 of the actual bill. Line 1.9 to 1.11 modifies the description of the providers who would be on the list for election. And it changes the time period from 6 to 12 months. Line 1.4 corrects a cross-reference. Line 1.15 to 1.16 is a technical correction for the effective date, because one of the amendments added last week had its own effective date. Line 1.7 clarifies the cite to Social Security laws. 1.8 through 1.21 of the amendment are strictly technical fixes. Line 1.22 deletes the background checks, and 1.23 to 1.26 are just technical conforming changes.
Thank you, Ms. White. Senator Benson, is there anything further on the amendment at this time?
No. Madam Chair, and thank you to Council for the walkthrough. I'll catch up.
Okay, thank you. So on the amendment to Senate File 778, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment passes. Okay, so we're going to begin with testimony. I have Marilyn Geller and Doreen Aristi. Please, I don't know who of you would like to go first, but whoever it is, please introduce yourself and begin your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
You almost have to swallow that microphone or we can't hear you like mine.
How's this? My name is Marilyn Geller, and I'm a child care provider in Beltrami County. My daughter and I provide child care in Bemidji. We don't live where we do daycare. I drive 40 miles round trip to provide child care for 10 hours a day, 5 days a week. My own children are growing with children of their own. I choose to be a child care provider because I know how important it is for parents to be able to go to work or school knowing their child is safe and cared for. I choose to be a child care provider because children are eager to learn. They yearn to be guided. They're challenging. They're fascinating. They're unpredictable. And they are so very honest. The union is organized by child care providers for child care providers. Who better to understand the needs and of providers and their concerns better than providers themselves? Since becoming involved with the efforts of Local 3400, I have connected with child care providers throughout Minnesota and have formed lasting friendships. We share the same concerns and we share the same goals. We work together for solutions to issues that all child care providers face. It is our goal to make sure that family child care providers have an affordable choice for parents. As a union, we give child care providers an opportunity to have a voice, just as I have an opportunity to have a voice in today's hearing. What we are asking for in obtaining collective bargaining rights is the right to be recognized as professionals who want to be a part of guiding this profession in a positive, constructive direction and allow each child care provider the opportunity to grow in education and training in order to better prepare our young children for the world. It is our responsibility to guide and teach them, and as parents and providers working together towards this goal, we can be successful. Thank you for allowing my voice to be heard.
Thank you very much, Ms. Geller.
Thank you.
Ms. Aristi?
Hello. Hello, everyone, and thank you very much for the opportunity to be heard today. I have traveled from Homer, New York, to be here because I believe it's very important. I've also traveled with a colleague who's also a child care provider, Roxanne Savage. I've been caring for children in my home for more than 20 years. As an educated, experienced early child care educator, I understand the impact of quality child care programs on children's development, families, and our community. I understand that as citizens of the United States in a democratic society, we have rights, responsibilities, and choices. However, here in Minnesota, child care providers aren't even offered the right to make the choice. I am an active member and representative of VOICE, Voice of Individual Child Care Educators, the Child Care Union in New York State. I am here to support my fellow child care providers in Minnesota that also offer quality child care services. Caring and teaching children in a home-based daycare is so much more than just babysitting, as you've heard from others. The business is very unique. It cannot be compared to any other profession. Many times, this business is not looked at with respect and recognition. Allowing child care providers the choice to form a union with collective bargaining will support the three R's, rights, recognition, and respect, for the importance of the job that we perform on a daily basis. Allowing child care providers the right to organize with collective bargaining capabilities will be beneficial to parents, providers, and especially young children. A child care provider will be supported with the strength of union with things such as affordable continuing education, professional development, legal representation, and affordable health insurance. Allowing the ability for child care providers to organize a union would only be the first step of many, many more steps in this democratic system. I have personally seen a child care union that works in New York State. It's productive and it supports quality care for children. A child care union can negotiate state subsidy child care funding so that low-income working parents can have the choice of deciding whether they want a quality care program or another kind of child care. They can choose an affordable quality program. Collective bargaining will allow providers to have the choice of having a voice with quality child care programs in Minnesota. Allowing providers to organize as a collective bargaining unit will show that providers are not just babysitters, but professional early child care educators. Children cared for by the provider who is a union member is given the opportunity to learn and grow in a quality program. This, in turn, will have a positive impact on our future. Children who are taught by early childhood educators are more likely to become successful, contributing individuals to our society as a whole. Allowing providers to organize will support their rights, their recognition, and respect for the job that they do. Our country's laws are based on the Constitution, and laws are made to protect we the people and protect our rights. To be able to make choices is a right as a United States citizen. the right to choose has somehow been lost for Minnesota daycare providers. The state law here has limited child care providers' rights to choose to have a labor union. How is this right when a person isn't even offered the choice to decide in a democratic government? How is this right that they are told they cannot even be offered the right to choose? How is this right that all Minnesota daycare providers' rights have been limited? To me, it's just not right. How is it that this is not correct? Well, to fix the problem, it's not an easy job. But by passing this bill, it will allow people that give quality care for children in their homes the opportunity to make the choice and decide on their own. They can have a voice that their opinion and their choices to join a labor union or not join a labor union. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We'll now have John Relieu and Trish Berger. And if I've mispronounced your name, I'll hope you'll introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, we have a handout here.
We have a handout.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Rouleau, and I am the Executive Director of Minnesota Majority. Minnesota Majority is a member of the Child Care Freedom Coalition, which is a group of five organizations who have pledged to help defend independent child care providers against unwanted unionization. The child care providers themselves have done a good job explaining why they do not want a union forced on them and do not want so-called fair share fees extracted from their bottom line. I am here to express a different thought. The women who own and operate child care businesses are strong, capable, and organized, but it's morally reprehensible what they've been put through over the last 8 years. Many child care providers have had to interrupt their businesses, particularly when committees such as these meet during the time when they are watching the children they care for. They lose income and travel great distances to the capital to defend themselves against an economic assault they've been withstanding for years. Some have kept up this fight for their independence at great personal expenses. What's happening here should not happen in a free society. To put it simply, one group wants a cut of the money that another group makes, and our government is actually seriously considering this. This is so obviously and fundamentally wrong that it is unconscionable what these child care providers have been subjected to in order to simply defend themselves. That is why several nonprofit organizations have come together to back up the child care providers. We simply could not sit on the sidelines and watch this travesty unfold. This is a bill that should have never seen the light of day. Please look into your hearts and realize the harm you're doing by even having these hearings. Please leave these women alone. Please don't advance this bill or forcibly unionize independent small business owners any further. Stop this bill now and let these women get back to the work of their businesses and caring for children. Do the right thing and vote no on Senate File 778 today. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Berger.
Hi. Hello, Madam Chair. My name is Trish Berger. I'm a licensed C2N educated child care provider from ESCO. I traveled all the way from ESCO. I oppose this bill on 778, and I urge you to vote no. And there are three reasons why. The exclusive bargaining takes away the freedom of association. We don't need that. We already have our associations. They can speak for us. It also lumps licensed and unlicensed providers together, trying to establish a labor bargaining group, which doesn't mean anything. We are not an unlicensed provider. We're licensed. We already have our training set up. We already have that stuff established. We already have programs, associations, parent-aware, all of that already set up. And by doing this and by regulating for the children who are on child care assistance, or what Senator Pappas actually refers to them as CCAPs, they are children, and they do need this benefit for their families. This is a benefit that is provided for their families. This is not our paycheck. This is not our paycheck. This is a benefit for their family. And the family would be having to pay us anyways. We are not going to be getting a different wage. I don't understand this. We charge our own wages. We set our own prices. I'm not exactly sure how you can raise our wages when we already set our own prices. Now, I'm not comfortable with pleading to you to hear my voice. I'm a very non-political person, but when it comes to my heart and my faith, I follow it. I would like to offer all senators a chance to open up transparency within our humanity. Senator Roger Reinert from Duluth, of whom I've never had the opportunity to shake hands with, came forward last week with Senator Miller from Winona to form the Purple Caucus, a group of senators willing to take a speaker peace oath and uphold better values and morals by following certain rules. If I were truly political, I would have called him up and formulated a big plan for media propaganda and such from my idea, but I'm not. I'm a simple child care provider and mother of six children. I also have a bachelor's in education. All that I do is for children, for growing their minds to be brilliant participants in life. As citizens, we all elected you to hold your position, and I don't think that we have been very fair to you in that. We expect you to make the best decisions with bombarding you with emails and phone messages and social media with technology gadgets. And I just really, I would like to request a motion to table this bill for 2 weeks and for you all to come and have a down-to-earth town hall meeting, first ever, with your constituents, and call it the Purple Caucus meeting. Then we can all take that oath at this meeting and come down, just down to earth, and talk about this bill. Talk about what effects it's going to have on these children that are receiving the child care assistance, because I know that many providers who are accepting it right now are saying that they will not be accepting any more child care assistance children because they do not want to have to be regulated by a union and for the union to take our own voice. We need to stand in solidarity, all of us, but be mature about it. And we need to be able to vocalize towards each other. I would like to request a town hall meeting called the Purple Caucus meeting, and I would be willing to help out if you'd like. We could have it here in St. Paul if you'd like with all of the senators. We could have it up where your areas are, your own Purple Caucus meeting. But we need to be able to listen to each other. Something needs to change because our children are seeing, we lead and live by example. Our children learn through observation. And if we're not setting a good example by listening to each other, then maybe we need to change the future. Maybe we need to modernize ourselves and look less into technology and look less into emailing all of you, all of our things, because you're just docking off a yes or a no. Go for this bill or that bill. Start to hear our voices. Start to hear what we think and what we feel. I would like to request a motion to table this bill in accordance to the people's right to freedom of speech and to build a community and trust with all branches of the government we have elected to be ours, unless you all want to vote to oppose this, of course. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Pappas, do you want to take some to have some discussion at this time, or do you want to proceed with the...
Madam Chair, I think I'd rather proceed with the second part of the bill and then discuss it all together, if it's okay with you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Section 2 of the bill, then, is about the home care workers who are the people who take care of our family members. They're the direct support workers who care for seniors and people with disabilities in their homes. These workers provide critical services that allow the elderly and people with disabilities to live at home with their families or independently in the community. So the bill is about ensuring accessibility, quality care to accessible quality care to Minnesotans through all stages of life by committing ourselves to workforce development in our long-term care system. And that's because we face a looming workforce crisis in our public home care programs. As demographics shift and the need for these services increase, there will not be enough workers to fill this need due to low wages, part-time hours, and a lack of benefits or training opportunities. To accomplish this, we must strengthen the workforce of our long-term care system. So Article 2 of this bill achieves this workforce development goal partially by creating an advisory council to the Commissioner of Human Services, which the chair mentioned is the focus of this committee, called the Quality Self-Directed Services Workforce Council, and also by allowing home care workers who are providing self-directed students services to join together in a union. So Subdivision 2 and 3 establishes the Quality Self-Directed Service Workforce Council as an advisory council. It's comprised of a majority of people with disabilities and seniors who use these programs and services themselves, plus the commissioner or her designee, and representatives from existing state, aging, and disability bodies. The purpose will be to advise the Commission of Human Services to address the workforce needs, including expanding access to options for self-direction for all service recipients, pursuing strategies to attract and retain a sufficient workforce, developing further efforts to prevent abuse and neglect, developing program orientation, training, educational opportunities. And then in addition, Subdivision 5 also mirrors those duties and gives those duties to the Commissioner of Human Services. And DHS is also charged with the establishment of a support worker registry. And that's another key part of the bill that would help match home care workers to recipients who need them. Because right now, you really are on your own. Unless you have a family member who's willing to provide care for you, you really, it's word of mouth to find someone who will find that care for you. They've been established in other states and have proven to be beneficial. Participation in this registry would be optional for both workers and recipients and would include information about the training and experience of individual providers, as well as other preference information, where they live, et cetera. And that's kind of the focus of the bill. So, Madam Chair, I'd like to bring up my testifiers.
Okay. We have Mark Kerwin and Nicole Villavicencio. Thank you. Please introduce yourselves to the committee.
Hi, my name is Mark Kerwin, and I live in Northeast Minneapolis, and I'm a home care worker for my wife, Chrissy, through the CDCS program. And I'm here to explain why I'm in favor of programs that protect things such as consumer-directed community supports. My wife and I have been married for 21 years, and we have two sons. My wife, Chrissy, was diagnosed with MS when she was 18. We got married in 1991, and we both worked until around 1998 when Chrissy had to stop working because of her worsening health. I had to drop down to working part-time because I needed to be home to take care of Chrissy, and at the time, I was not getting paid for caring for my wife. Eventually, it started looking like Chrissy was going to need to move into a healthcare facility because we weren't able to make it work financially. That changed when we got on the CDCS program and I was able to start getting paid for taking care of my wife. In 2007, Chrissy was hospitalized with a serious infection. She had seizures and she was unresponsive for nearly a week. She was put on a ventilator and a feeding tube, and we were not sure if she would pull through. We were told by the social workers that after her hospital stay that she would have to move to a healthcare facility. And we did not have a support system in place at the time for her to safely live at home. Chrissy was only 40 years old when she moved into the healthcare facility. I'll never forget how sad I was driving to visit her at the new place and thinking, wow, Chrissy really doesn't live with us anymore. She'll probably have to live there for the rest of her life. Our boys were 6 and 9 at the time, and we had to travel about a half an hour to see her, and we all hated her seeing her in that facility. And Chrissy made it very clear that she did not want to stay in that healthcare facility, and she wanted to go home. We found out that she was eligible for a CAC waiver that would give her more funding, which would enable us to set up a system where she could go home. Now we have 52 hours a week of registered nurses, and I am paid 40 hours a week. It was a huge relief, and the program has been working well for our family. Chrissy has been able to live at home now for about the last 6 years. I am very grateful for CDCS, and it has enabled my family to stay together. But most people have never had to go through an experience like that. they have not lived with a severely disabled loved one, and so I think it can be hard for them to fully appreciate the value of a program like CDCS or how important the services are that home care workers provide. Without CDCS, Chrissy would still be in a facility, and taxpayers would have to spend much more money for her care. Without home care workers like myself, this program would not work as well as it does. Having worked with her for so many years, I am very experienced and know all the details of her health care, and as such, I feel like I provide high-quality care. And so I'm in favor of an organized voice that can speak up in defense of home health care and hopefully to protect our budgets and making sure that our services are valued. CDCS was there for my family when we needed it, and I would like to see it protected for not only for my family but for others who will face a similar challenge trying to keep their families together. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nicole Villavicencio Tellison, and I am a mother, a leader of my community, and a peer mentor. Without my personal care attendant services, I wouldn't be able to do or be any of these things. My direct support workers work for me from the time I get up in the morning and get ready for my day until I tuck my daughter into bed and go to sleep at the end of the day. I have relied on direct support workers for over 12 years. The best support workers are the ones who listen and take direction while also being able to take initiative. I need people who understand that I am a confident, independent woman who uses support services and not someone who is sick or broken or needs care. As good as some of my direct support workers have been, I have faced many challenges getting the support I need. It is difficult to find quality, reliable people who are willing and able to work for low wages and no benefits. When I do find someone who is really good and reliable, they always end up leaving to make more money. My aunt worked for me for 4 years. She enjoyed the work and was one of the best workers I've ever had. Unfortunately, she had to quit and get a different job so she could provide for her children. This has happened over and over again. When people do stay and work for me full-time, they often have to rely on public assistance to be able to feed their families and get health care for their own children. The only way for a direct support worker to provide for her family without using public assistance is to work for more than one job. This means that their schedules can't always be flexible as I need them to be. Me and other disability advocates have worked hard and will continue to work hard to ensure that everyone who needs self-directed support services has access to them. But no matter how hard we fight, our services will always be in danger as long as direct support workers are expected to work for low wages with no benefits, little access to training, and no voice to change those things. It's time to give my direct support workers a voice. If my workers have a better quality of life, my family and I have a better quality of life. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I don't have any more testifiers based on your limitations. So.
Okay, thank you. We also have presentations from Kara Benson and Lisa Kampfer. Would you introduce yourself and begin your testimony, please?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Lisa Kampfer, and I am with Consumer Directions, a fiscal support entity certified by DHS to provide administrative and payroll support to families when they choose to employ their own workers. We serve approximately 650 individuals who are self-directing their services under CDCS, Consumer Directed Community Supports. I have been an advocate of this model since it began in Minnesota in 1998. I am here to testify today because I oppose how this bill confuses the facts by grouping consumer-directed community supports and PCA Choice. We are separate programs and separate workforces. This bill takes away the core and fundamental principles of the CDCS participant being able to have the flexibility to set and determine workers' wages. Here are the successes resulting from the participant control over staff compensation and employment. The average wage for a CDCS worker is $13.26 an hour. This is actual data compiled by a collaboration of FSEs as of March 4, 2013. Additionally, we know the average length of tenure in CDCS is 34 months. 38% have worked 5 years or more. 87.6% of this workforce is comprised of family and friends. These workers are predominantly doing this out of labor of love and not in pursuit of a career in caregiving. This leads me to concerns. Will an older sister, brother, cousin, aunt, uncle, grandparent, or parent have to join a union to provide care to a loved one? CDCS is an evidence-based program that is working. These statistics do not support the need for a collective bargaining unit for the CDCS workers, as these statistics show that there is already a reliable, accessible, trained workforce of trusted caregivers with a low rate of staff turnover who are receiving better wages. Did you know half of the people we serve under CDCS are set up as household domestic employers and that they directly hire their employees under their own employer identification number? The IRS has recognized these employers as home health care service recipients. Under the definition in the National Labor Relations Act, any individual employed in the domestic service of any family or person in their home, or any individual employed by their parent or spouse, is exempt. Please separate these workforces and consider amending this bill to exclude the participants who are household domestic employers. I would like to think we all have a shared value in supporting the philosophy of self-direction and the resulting fiscal savings that consumer-directed community supports provides. And with that, we are committed and willing to work with the authors of this bill so that we do not lose the viability of self-directed models in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Benson?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kara Benson, and I'm a program director at AcroCare. I am here to oppose Senate File 778, specifically the portion regarding the unionization of the entire personal care assistance and consumer-directed community support workforce, irrespective of employer circumstance. AcroCare helps recipients set up their PCA choice services. AcroCare performs the necessary background check on the PCA. The qualified professional works with the recipient and their PCAs to develop a care plan. AcroCare submits all paperwork and billing to the state and provides the PCA's payroll. We employ approximately 2,600 PCA choice workers. Their average wage at our agency is $12.35 per hour. Even though the individual or their representative selects their own worker, AcroCare is the employer. This legislation creates a great deal of uncertainty for recipients, forces family members to join a union in order to receive a care entitlement, and creates more paperwork and costs for business like AcroCare. This legislation means that our employees do not have to sign cards indicating they want an election and can have no vote. And the numbers are such that they will still be forced to surrender some of their limited income to a union with essentially no power. This bill does not grant the potential union striking power. It only grants exclusive negotiations with the state, but those negotiations are not binding. The union can reach an agreement with Minnesota management and budget, and due to budget constraints, the legislature can vote that agreement down and establish a new pay rate for PCAs in exactly the same way it is done today. The union can then go to binding arbitration, which again can be voted down by this legislature. PCAs are important people to our society. The work is not easy. They deserve respect and to get the best rate for their hard work. I know some of you on this committee have supported a bill to increase home and community-based service rates by 5%. Thank you for doing that. That increase will be passed on to direct care workers, including PCAs, who do this important work. If you pass the bill to unionize self-directed workers, those employees will need to pay up to 2% for union dues, taking away from the increase they deserve. This bill has too many questions and not enough answers. Does a son caring for his sick mother 10 hours a week need to pay union dues? Where do the dues come from? Will parents no longer be allowed to take an entitlement without joining a union? This bill also leaves much about its training requirements unknown. Who would provide and pay for this training? How long would the training take? Would this training cause delay in a family member providing care services to their parent or child, thus taking away the recipient's preference for their caregiver? Will the training requirements exclude certain people, including immigrants, from doing this important work? Will the training be verified through the state licensing? How is the state going to pay for this training, and what is the fiscal note? Finally, when talking about consumer-directed community support services, creating a union wage through the state eliminates all flexibility. A woman with MS will no longer be able to pay her daughter minimum wage to sit with her in the evening and pay an experienced, qualified worker to help during the day. She will be limited to one wage. She will lose the flexibility that she currently has to stretch her dollars as she chooses. That, members of the committee, goes against everything the self-directed model seeks to create. I urge you to take the time to see how this will impact services for people before passing the bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. I would just like to ask a question of... Lisa? Yeah,
Lisa Camphor.
Lisa Camphor, thank you. I may have misunderstood what you were saying, and so I was trying to understand something that you said while we were listening here. I'm sorry. But I heard you say that you thought that something in this language, in Article 2, I expect, takes away the capacity of an individual to do a self-directed model of care, and I'm not seeing that in the language. So would you expand on that and articulate what it is you're seeing here that creates that concern for you?
And Madam Chair, it certainly is not our intention, and so we would certainly want to clarify the language if that's not clear.
Under the current programs that the individuals that are choosing to direct their own care under consumer-directed community supports, they're able to hire, fire, set the rate of pay, schedule, train, and if the union comes in, they're going to be taking that away from these individuals who, like Kara had said, may want to hire someone that's maybe just going to sit with them in the evening at a lower rate of pay, but then we might have someone that's much more qualified with more experience, more education, and so on and so forth that may need to get paid $15.50 an hour. We don't want the union to be able to dictate that everyone is going to get a set rate of pay regardless of the duties that they perform. We don't want, you know, this across the board type of thing.
Okay, thank you. That clarifies that it's not that they wouldn't be able to hire their own person. An organization like yous might do background checks and various kinds of facilitations of what it means for an individual who's paying the provider how to withhold from their payment check or to cover workman's compensation or whatever else that they do. That wouldn't change, but the issue is that right now, from your perspective, an individual negotiates the rate as well with their person, and that there's a variable of that depending on what the service request is or what the background capacity is of the person.
Correct.
That's what your concern is.
The rate of pay, we have families that offer benefits, families that don't offer benefits. They have the flexibility to choose what works best for that individual in their home, whether it's a child all the way to end of life.
Okay, thank you. I was hearing you say that the whole concept of self-directed care was eliminated as a result of this proposal, but that's much more distinct. Thank you very much.
Well, and Madam Chair, that certainly should be taken under consideration as the council does its work, that there should be different rates of compensation depending on the type of work. So, I mean, I don't think that's inconsistent with the bill. There's nothing in here that dictates that everyone would get paid the same rate.
But is it implied in what you're saying that the council would negotiate that rather than the individual in terms of establishing the rates, that it would be the council that would establish those rates and not the individual who is receiving and hiring the person to care for them?
I might need some help with this, Madam Chair, but I think that I need someone. I need my advisor here.
That's great. Okay, we can free up the chairs and let others come forward.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Zafran. I'm a public policy specialist with SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. And I'd just like to underscore what you were just going through with Ms. Kampfer, which is in Article 2 on page 5. And the section subdivision 4 starting on line 5.18, that no provision of any agreement reached between the state and any exclusive representative shall interfere with the rights of participants or the representatives to select, hire, direct, supervise, and terminate the employment of their individual providers, to manage an individual service budget regarding the amounts and types of authorized goods or services received, or to receive direct support services from individual providers not referred to them through a state registry. And what that makes clear, especially in the second provision about managing an individual service budget, is that it would still be up to the individual to manage their own budget regardless of a negotiated wage floor between any exclusive representative if these workers do choose to form a union and with the state.
Would you say your last name again and spell it for me?
Sure. Zafran, Zaffrann.
So, Mr. Zafran, what you're saying is that there would be a floor in terms of what the payment rate would be. That wouldn't be negotiable if there's unionization, but anything, that if you'd want to increase that, that would still be possible for the individual.
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct. This group of workers, should they choose to form a union, would have the ability to negotiate a wage floor.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. The group that is here may wonder why we're restricting the testimony to this. I did note in the testimony that much was focused on the idea, the concept of unionization, which we certainly will want to have a thorough consideration of. But I am interested in, the concepts here of the self-directed services workforce, what that does for us, what it accomplishes, what is there in this that is other than the negotiation for wages that an association could not do as opposed to a union. We've had testimony about there being an association that accomplishes certain, has the capacity to accomplish certain objectives. So some consideration as to why one or the other is a better choice. And I wanted to leave plenty of time in the hearing for committee members to really have conversation with each other and with the author about the implications of this proposal on our Department of Human Services and the role that it plays in assuring quality child care and services for long-term care or disabled persons. So with that, I'm sort of opening it up now to the committee members for conversation and discussion. Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In reference to negotiating a wage floor, how does that work? With whom would a union representative be negotiating?
Madam Chair and Senator Nino.
Senator Pappas.
Management and Budget.
Senator Nino.
But Senator Pappas, Management and Budget doesn't establish the reimbursements. The legislature does.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, they would have to be approved by the legislature like we approved the state contracts.
Senator Nienau?
So, Senator Pappas, if management and budget and the union come to an agreement, but the legislature doesn't appropriate the money, that agreement becomes meaningless?
Senator Pappas?
Madam Chair, I'm trying to think if we've ever done that, but it would work like any other state contract. I assume management and budget would have to have a sense of what the legislature has in its budget and the capability we have for any kind of adjustments in wage like they do with state employees. So it would basically work the same way.
Senator Nienau.
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, I think I pretty significantly disagree. If a state employee union negotiates a wage schedule, and the contract is approved, the legislature might or might not appropriate enough money to cover that salary schedule for all the employees. The department then will have to adjust accordingly and reduce staff. In this scenario, we have small independently owned businesses. They can't just decide to reduce staff and lay off people. It's just not going to be able to take effect unless the legislature appropriates the money. And we're kind of getting to the larger point that I was making, is that when it comes to these independently owned businesses, because we're not talking about an employee pool, we're talking about independently owned businesses, they can't operate the same way with a collective bargaining unit that say, for example, a state employee union would. If they come to an agreement, and if MMB or who, whatever department approves it, it means really nothing unless the legislature appropriates any funding to correlate that with to correlate with whatever that agreement came to, which then ultimately means that if they're going to have any kind of negotiation, it really is with the legislature. And that gets back to your point, Madam Chair, about the trade organization. That's what they do. They lobby. You don't negotiate with the legislature. I remember sitting in this room with a representative from the Vikings sitting at that table and selling the Viking stadium plan, and I was asking some questions, and why shouldn't we do this, why shouldn't we do that, and the answer I kept getting back was, well, that's not what was negotiated. And I said to the gentleman at the table, with all respect, you're not in a negotiation here. You need to convince this committee, I think it was the Finance Committee, you need to convince this committee that what you're proposing is a good idea, because we're not negotiating. You're lobbying, you're selling, but you're not negotiating. They didn't like that response, but that's the reality. And that's what we have here, and this is where I'm trying to get my hands around. How does this even work? If the idea is to negotiate a wage floor, well, no, you can't. You can lobby for a wage floor, but you're not going to be able to negotiate that because this committee here doesn't negotiate. We debate, we discuss, we talk about policy, and then we'll send things off to the budget committee, who will then determine what the spending level should be. And that's not a negotiation. That's a collective committee and then legislative decision. And that's why we have trades organizations that come down here and lobby. So I don't see how the union can fulfill a function different than what the trades unions do. And I guess I'll just end that right there. And obviously, Senator Pappas, if you want to respond.
Well, Senator Pappas. Senator Nienau, I mean, you could think about it as just another way to organize a united voice. Now, you have, like you said, lobbying organizations and associations, and you have unions. It's just another way to organize, to influence public policy, except that it's a different approach, because instead of lobbying us, they would be, in a sense, lobbying or negotiating with MMB for higher rates, whether it's for the child care subsidy or for the PCA payments. How this works, if there are finite budgets, I think it's a discussion in process, and I think we're going to have to figure, if we make it to the Finance Committee, that's probably going to be the place there where we'll have to have that more intense discussion. in here, because I think we're going to have to think about that. Obviously, like you said, if we negotiate a contract with state employees, and the governor, we did, and we just approved one, and the governor said to the state agencies, but I'm not proposing any additional money for you to cover that 2% or whatever it was, you have to take that out of your existing budget. So that could be the case here as well. It comes out of the existing, whatever the budget is for child care subsidy or whatever the budget is for personal care attendance. The difficulty, of course, with personal care attendants is that if people don't get that care, they may end up in nursing homes, and then we pay for it through another pot of money, pay for it through Medicaid. So I guess this is a little, the financial complications of this is still a little bit above my pay grade, but, you know, I'm learning, and I hope that by the time, if we make it to Finance Committee, we'll have more clarity on this.
Senator Nino.
Madam Chair, thank you. That was interesting. I think you've just highlighted a serious concern in the structure of this proposal. If what you're proposing is that the bargaining unit would go to MMB and negotiate a contract, and that contract would then operate similarly to like state employees would, if we have to lay people off, would operate under this new agreement and they would pay higher rates within a capitation, then you're going to run out. And if that happens, people aren't going to get their services. We're either going to start rationing daycare services more than we do, or as you said, people are going to end up in long-term care. And that's the problem with not negotiating with the body that controls the purse strings. And when you're in a business, you're negotiating, or if you're a state employee unit, you're negotiating with the people that control the funding. The department controls the funding. We give them a capitated allotment, but they control how that all gets spent. In this circumstance, that's not the case. And if you're not dealing directly with the legislature, and if you have a third party, if you will, MMB, making decisions outside of the legislative process, if you will, when you have a capitated dollar figure, you're going to run into problems there. And that kind of gets back to my point of I think this whole process will be better served with the trades organizations representing the interest of those that are receiving these subsidies, but also working directly with the legislature. Now, the union certainly can lobby, but the purpose of a union primarily, unless it's coming to policy issues like this. I mean, they've certainly done a lot of lobbying on this particular issue. The primary purpose of a union is to protect the workers and to negotiate with the employer. And ultimately, in this case, if you want to look at it, it really doesn't fit into the collective bargaining arrangement, but if you want to look at it, the legislature ultimately becomes the employer because we're the ones that are allocating the funds. And it just, it really seems convoluted and problematic to try to go this route, I guess is my point.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I guess my perspective is that for these low-wage workers, that any method that they are allowed to legally employ to make their case for adequate wages should be allowed. I mean, this is not, we're not handing this to them on a silver platter. There's a lot of steps that have to be gone through, and we cover that thoroughly in my committee. But the idea of, you know, capitation is in the system wherever we go. And the Department of Human Services makes adjustments all the time within their budget. And the child care subsidy also is a budget where adjustments are made. But the current system has not been very beneficial for these groups of workers. I mean, child care subsidy rates for licensed homes were dropped, I believe, 2.4% over the last 2 years, and for unlicensed homes, they dropped 14%. Personal care attendant wages have been frozen for a number of years. Very, very occasionally, there's like a 1% increase. So if we're going to keep viable daycare homes affordable and available for our children, there's been a drop in the number of daycare homes, partially due to the recession, but partially due to the fact that people aren't making decent wages. And as I mentioned in my opening comments, with the demographics changing, more and more people are going to need these personal care attendants if we want to keep them out of very expensive nursing homes. I know how expensive they are. I've had my mother in one. They just raised the rate from $6,800 a month to $8,600 a month. And she's still private pay. But when she goes to the elderly waiver, then the state picks up a substantial portion of that. So we need to be able to have these options for people to stay in their own homes. So it's another method that other states have tried. We have over a dozen states around the country that have instituted the option for workers to form a union if they wish, and the sky hasn't fallen. And they've had, I wish the woman from New York had talked a little bit more about the positive results in New York. I think her handout goes through that they have been able to increase quality and affordability for parents. And it's been true in other states with PCAs as well.
Thank you. Other members of the committee? Senator Rosen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. But Senator Pappas, the only thing I do question is you're talking about how this is going to affect demographics going forward, and I'm looking at the availability of daycare providers out in Greater Minnesota and how this CCAP is going to affect them and how it's already onerous on these providers and how it's difficult finding good quality licensed daycare providers in Greater Minnesota. There just aren't out there. So their distance is going to be exaggerated going forward, and that is going to be a hindrance on job creation. I have, fortunately, I have one community that's just expanding with jobs. Not that many communities, just one out of the 40 that I represent. And housing and licensed daycare providers is their biggest issue. They don't know what to do. They're thinking of putting in something into the workforce area, but still there has to be a lot of options, and I do think this bill is going to really affect people out in Greater Minnesota.
Senator Pappas?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, I actually don't see how it would have a huge effect. If you were a provider who didn't take child care subsidy, in either case, you negotiate your rates with the parents of the children you serve. But if you don't take child care subsidy, you don't have to be in the union. If you do take child care subsidy, you don't have to be in the union anyway either. But as all unions work, if the majority decide to join the union, then you would be subject to fair share, which is a lower than the union dues. The woman who was up here a minute ago said something about 2% for union dues. With PCAs, I'm not aware of any discussion. Do you know if there's discussion on union dues? It would be totally up to the group of workers to decide what their union dues would be. In the daycare area, the group of workers who are organizing have proposed $25 a month for their dues, which may be equivalent to associations. I don't know.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Pappas, but we're talking about two different things here, of course, the licensed care provider and the personal care attendant. And any option that's going to inhibit or take away the ability for more licensed providers out there, whether they have the option of joining the union, in Greater Minnesota is a problem for me. And you say they have the option, but if they're forced to join into it, they're going to go find something different.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen,
Senator Pappas.
They're not forced to join. There's no force involved. It's choice.
Senator Pappas or Senator Rosen,
you're close.
Excuse me. But they still have to pay fair share.
If they accept child care subsidy. So the trade-off for them, Madam Chair, is they take child care subsidy and the union is going to be advocating for higher child care subsidy rates, which means that parents will have higher subsidy. Therefore, it will be more affordable for the parents. They'll be more likely to join the workforce. And more customers for the family daycare provider. And then the family daycare provider won't feel like they're in a position to cross-subsidize and just charge the child care subsidy rate or refuse to take the parents because they can't pay the full rate, or the parents would have to pay over and above that. So it is true that the goal here is to put pressure on the state for a higher child care subsidy, and Senator Marty, I know, has that bill, and to provide higher wages for personal care attendants. That is true. That is a goal here with this legislation.
And Madam Chair?
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Pappas just answered my question. They are not going to take child subsidy. They're not going to do the CCAP. They'll just take parents that can pay full wage. And that's a problem in greater Minnesota. You're going to see a big kickback on that because we don't have the ability around here to just drive 10 miles either direction or 5 miles and hopefully find a good licensed daycare provider.
Madam Chair,
Senator Pappas?
I don't know the answer off the top of my head, but I would be happy to do the research and find out in other states where they've allowed this, if there has been what the percentage of daycare providers have then dropped CCAP totally. I'd be happy to find that out. I know there were some providers in my committee who said that they would do that, but most of them are very irregular users of CCAP in the first place.
Madam Chair.
Yeah, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Senator Pappas, just listening to my providers and their association, they can guarantee me they will drop CCAP. So, I mean, there will be ramifications.
And Senator Rosen, would you say again for me what it is that drives that decision in the rural area from what you're hearing from your constituents? What is it about this proposal that increases their interest in dropping the CCAP participation?
Madam Chair, because they don't want to be forced into a fair share, or that there is this option of being unionized. There is no good reason right now to have this because they are doing the educational component. The licensed providers that I've talked to, they're required 8 hours per year for continuing ed. Some are up to almost 20 hours. And so they take this as a profession. So they're very serious about keeping up to the standards and continuing their ed. And they don't see any reason why they should be penalized for taking child subsidy.
Thank you. Senator Nelson and then Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Pappas. I have a kind of a just a higher order question here, and that is these are all independent daycare providers or personal care attendants, and I think you're saying that I'm saying who is the employer, and you're telling us the state is the employer. So I'm thinking about that, and I'm looking at, there's a big debate in Washington, D.C., and even here in Minnesota about rightfully classifying employees. It appears to me that at the very minimum, or at the very maximum, child care providers could be considered independent contractors with the state. But to say that they're employees, it doesn't fit. The IRS, you can look at the right to control test, whether they're independent contractors or employees. And if we had technology here that would allow me to print off my iPad, I would print this for you. But you can look at it yourself. But there's 20 factors that are considered in trying to determine if someone is an independent contractor or an employee. And the feds are cracking down on folks who are truly independent contractors, but they're misclassified as employees. And just listen to some of these. Level of instruction. If the company, or in this case, the employer, directs when, where, and how a work is done, this control indicates a possible employment relationship. Well, that's not the case here with child care workers. Extent of personal services. Companies or the state, the employer, that insists on a particular person performing the work assert a degree of control that suggests an employment relationship. In contrast, independent contractors typically are free to assign work to anyone. So that doesn't fit. You can just go right down through all these. You can look at flexible of schedule. People whose hours or days of work are directed by a company, or in this state, the employer, are apt to qualify as its employees. Well, that's not the case here. Sequence of work. If a company requires work to be performed in a specific order or sequence, this control suggests an employment relationship. Well, this doesn't fit. That doesn't fit for daycare providers or personal care attendants. Payment of business expenses. Independent contractors typically bear the cost of business expenses, and most contractors set their fees high enough to cover those. But direct reimbursement of other business costs by a company or employer suggests an employment relationship. Well, that doesn't fit for child care providers. And I could go down through all of these 20 characteristics, and you could too, and you would see that they do not fit. Child care providers are not employees of the state of Minnesota based upon our current laws and based upon IRS. At a very minimum, one could say they're independent contractors. But I think that, so I'd like you to kind of comment on that. And if you really do think they're employees, then I want to know, I don't know, is the state going to withhold Social Security? Is the state going to pay Social Security on these employees? Are they going to pay unemployment insurance or health care or pensions? So I just think it's a very high-level question, but I think it's very important, and I'd like you to comment on that.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, Sarah Nelson. It's a new category. It's a new classification, and it's only for purposes of negotiating the CCAP dollars or the rates for PCAs, and it doesn't include any of the other rights or responsibilities of other state employees. So it's they don't have the right to strike, they don't have the right to the state health care plan or to state pensions. So it is a new categorization.
Okay.
So Senator Nelson.
Thank you for clarifying that second part of my question. But what about the fact that by all accounts, the characteristics that determine an independent contractor versus an employee, and I wish I could print this for you so you could see it in front of you, but it's easy to find, and I will get it to you when we can do that. By all accounts, I don't think anyone could at all for one moment think that daycare providers meet the federal requirements of employees. One could say they're independent contractors with the state, but I don't see any way that one could construe daycare providers to be considered employees. And I think that's what your legislation is asking for here.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the case of home daycare providers and PCAs, who's going to pay the dues? Let's start with home daycare providers. Will it be the parents who are going to have to pay it, or will the provider just get less money?
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I actually don't know the mechanics of how it would be paid, if it would be paid directly to the union or if it would be subtracted from the child care payment. I don't know if that's in the legislation. Does anybody know? I don't think it is in the legislation. So I think that's to be determined, maybe negotiated between MMB and the union if they get the exclusive.
I think that there's specific language to that in the bill, Senator Pappas, that does not allow that. Would you introduce, are you here to speak to that question, and would you introduce yourself?
Chair Sharon, I'm Jennifer Munt. I'm the Public Affairs Director for AFSCME Council 5. In the case of the child care providers, they would give authorization to have their union dues deducted from the CCAP payment that they receive from the state.
Madam Chair, and if
is,
I could...
Excuse me, is that language in the bill?
I believe so.
I'm going to look a little bit here. Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, the only thing I see possibly is page 4, line 7, no use of scholarship for dues or fees.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Pappas.
I don't have the PELRA statutes with me, but we believe it's referenced to the existing PELRA chapters. That's how it works.
Okay, and Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas, would you look at Section 4 on page 4? Mm-hmm. It says, early learning scholarships shall not be applied through state withholding or otherwise toward payment of dues or fees that are paid to exclusive representation of family child care providers.
Right, that was, Madam Chair, that was an amendment added in my committee, and it is kind of prospective. If we do authorize the early learning scholarships, I think there's a little bit of money in that fund right now, that the dues could not be taken out of the early learning scholarships. Because this has to do with CCAP, the child care subsidy.
Okay. Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, maybe I need some clarification. I thought the child care subsidy went, in most cases, to the parent, not to the provider. Could somebody clarify that for me?
Senator Pappas. The CCAP dollars go directly to the parents. That is correct. They go to the provider.
Chair Sharon,
yes.
The CCAP payments go to the provider. The payments are, the parent chooses their provider, and the state pays the provider who's chosen by the parent to care for her children.
Okay. Does that answer your question, Senator Benson? Ms. Mont, did you want to answer the question?
Chair Sharon, somebody who receives payments from the state through CCAP would be a member of the union. If you
my question is yes.
Right. If you
could be a provider.
Something happened that I started qualifying for CCAP payments. They would have to consent to having dues withheld from the CCAP, or they would have to drop me.
It would make them eligible then to be part of the union. So if they chose to be part of the union, then they would pay full dues. And if they chose to not be part of the union, then they would be assessed a fair share.
Right.
But,
so they
but
would
the payment what we're talking about is the person, if I understand your question correctly, Senator Benson, the question is, if I choose not to be, if I am a CCAP provider and I choose not to be a part of a union, but there is a union and I am assessed the fair share.
Right.
Is that automatically deducted out of the CCAP payment, or do I have to agree to that, actively agree to that? Is that correct, Senator Benson?
Yes, in part. I mean, it sounds like somebody's getting less money for doing the same job simply because one of their parents moved into CCAP. They didn't fundamentally change the work that they were doing for that child, but now all of a sudden a third party has seen fit to insert themselves into the parent-child-provider relationship.
Senator Pappas.
Well, Madam Chair, hopefully the advantage to being in the union is that the parent would receive higher CCAP payments. That's the goal, is to raise the CCAP payments. So then the small amount that would be deducted from that payment, there still would be an overall gain, one would hope. Otherwise, why go through this whole exercise?
So if I were to summarize that, I think the issue is obviously if there's going to be an organized union of providers who are able to or eligible for CCAP, that there will be a cost assessed for the work of that union, and that all members, whether they join the union or not, will benefit from the outcome of that negotiation. So all will be expected to make at least some contribution toward that. And because of that, it is true, as Senator Benson says, that at least for a while, or depending on the success or lack of success of the negotiations, there'll be less money coming for the CCAP payment, because some of it is now not going for the provision of the services, but it's going to pay for the organizational work towards negotiating the work conditions.
And Madam Chair, if I could ask
Senator Benson?
And I'm sorry, I have forgotten the union representative.
Mrs. Monte.
Ms. Monte. What is the goal for raising the CCAP payment subsidy? Because I've heard $25 a month mentioned for daycare provider dues. So what's the goal for the increase in CCAP?
The
Ms. Mont?
Chair Sharon, Senator Benson, the intent is to raise the reimbursement rates so that parents pay less and providers can make enough money that they can afford to support their own payments. What we have seen with the last legislature is that the payments for licensed providers were cut 2.5%, and the payments for unlicensed providers were cut 14.5%. If our goal is to prepare kids for school and to make sure that they are well-fed and prepared to learn, it makes it increasingly difficult to do that when your wages that are already low continue to be cut by the legislature.
And Madam Chair, what I didn't hear was an answer.
To
what dollar amount are you looking to raise CCAP?
Ms. Mon.
Senator Sharon, we don't have a dollar amount that we hope to raise CCAP by. We would get to that in negotiations if the providers choose a union.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Benson,
if I may ask, we have experience with New York. Held up as an example. So how much were their subsidies raised by compared to the union dues that they pay?
Ms. Mon?
Senator Sharon, I don't know the exact amount. I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, it appears we have a testifier who might be able to answer that.
No, you'll have to approach the table and reintroduce yourself for the record. There's a tape recorder running, and so we need to know who's speaking.
Yes,
that's why we ask for the names all the time.
Hi, I'm Doreen Aristi. I am from New York State. In New York State, we have a 75th percentile of the market rate at this point. That's what DSS subsidy is paying. And the union dues, the providers who decide to have a labor union will make their own decisions on what the rates will be and what the dues will be. In New York State, we have decided that $35 was the minimum for member dues per month. We also have made it a difference that there's a range of payment for member dues. We go from $420 to $720, depending on the income of the provider. The more you make, the more you support the labor union. The less you make, there's a minimum floor due. Those that decide not to become a member are also paid into their fair share.
So, Madam Chair, just a little information for the committee in New York. She mentioned that they are able to get 75% of the market rate for a child care subsidy. In Minnesota, it's about 45% of the market rate.
What is 45%, Senator Pappas? The current rate you're talking about.
Of the market rate for child care. Right, that's what the subsidy pays.
And
Madam Senator
Chair,
Benson,
if I may ask, what was the New York percent of market rate prior to the union?
We were at 75th, and with the labor union, we stayed at the 75th percentile.
Okay, so the costs for the providers, Madam Chair, went up, but the subsidy percentage did not.
Exactly. Well, it stayed the same. Had the labor union not been there to negotiate, the percentile would have went down.
Senator Benson, is that Senator? I think Senator Nelson was. Did you have another question? I'm sorry, I'm losing.
I don't. I'm just waiting for the documents to come so everyone can see those classification differences.
Thank you, Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just to answer Senator Benson's question. It's in the handout that the in New York since 2009. I'll just read it. Reimbursement rates in New York have stayed the same or increased slightly. So my inference is they basically stay flat, is how I read that.
Madam Chair,
thank you, Senator Nino.
Senator Pappas. During the time when our rates went down, so they were able to stabilize them, and I'm sure that New York had a lot of the same fiscal challenges that we have had here over the last few years.
Senator Pappas, inherent in the CCAP program is that it's a capitated fund. And that means that we as the legislature establish a certain pot, a size of the pot. So one of the concerns that I have in my district and throughout the state is that if the negotiations create an increase in what the provider rates are, that what we're doing is redirecting, that's obvious, we're redirecting more resources towards provider rates, and then there's less available for actual families becoming covered under this particular program, a program that already has a substantial waiting list for it. So could you talk about this issue, because I think Health and Human Services, as much as talking about whether or not, as Senator Nelson is struggling with, whether or not the child care provider is a consultant, or if it is an independent person, or if it is an employee. For me, the question is the obligation, as best we can within our budget, to provide child care services for as many families as possible. And there is there a buy? There's in that may the answer may be yes to this, that as it always is for us, if we draw more money out of our budget towards wages or salaries, that it reduces the overall capacity of the system to offer services to a broader group of people. That's question one. And then the second one is that I heard something about to negotiate rates. Is it? I'm not sure about the rules. If a person's on the CCAP program, can the parent pay more than what the rate is? Can they supplement whatever is the agreed rate for that particular program? And is that what you're talking about in terms of negotiating a higher salary or rate?
Madam Chair, let me take the first part of that question. This is a classic problem. And you can see it in minimum wage. If you raise the minimum wage, does that mean that some people will get laid off from their jobs and less people will be employed? No. It's an argument with the state grant for students, for higher ed students. If you do you spread the state grant among more students, or do you concentrate the state grant among the more needy students that need it more, and then some students don't get it or get much, much less? So I think this is a very similar situation where we have a waiting list, right, and we don't have a robust reimbursement. We have both problems. And if we can get an organized effort, because that's the way it works around here, to attack both those issues, where we need a higher reimbursement rate and we need more money in the overall pot, so that more working families can work, basically, and not be on public assistance. And that drains also money from the state, from a different pot of money, and it's also then we're not even talking about the benefits to kids being in a structured environment while their parents are working.
I'd like to just... Oh, were you going to answer?
That's okay. We can stick with this.
Well, I'm trying to think about how in private industry, where there is a union organization within that's negotiating the interests of the workforce with the corporation or with the manufacturing company, and the union negotiates a certain change in benefit set or an increase in salary over a certain period of time. The corporation in that circumstance has the capacity to increase the price of their product in order to accommodate to that, or to take a little less profit. Fat chance. or that's a possibility, or both, you know, to raise a little bit and take a little less profit in order to create a better resolution with the workforce. But when we're talking about the state of Minnesota as the employer, the capacity to do that runs into the conflict of ideologies around the size of government and raising, getting through a legislature, even though there's a negotiated deal with the Office of Budget Management, to be able to get more dollars into the system to accomplish that is a very difficult thing. It's very different than the private sector, and as it should be, but it does create this outcome that I think we should be absolutely clear about, that we're a risk that we're going to take here is that we will serve fewer people. Do you agree with that?
Madam Chair, having a organized group of, you know, it's like the squeaky wheel gets the grease. You know, if you have an organized group out there that's talking to their legislators, and because it's a dual track, it's not just negotiating with MMB, it's also educating legislators about the importance. It's just like state employees do now. If they negotiate a 1% or 2% increase, that money does have to come from somewhere, and the legislature is faced with, do we raise revenue or do we reprioritize funding? We take the money from somewhere else because this has become a higher priority.
But Senator Pappas, why couldn't the association, there's this other model which is called an association. We have many associations here lobbying the legislature for growth in the waivered services or growth in payment rates to nursing home facilities or growth. These are associations that groups join, the Minnesota Medical Association, the Minnesota Nurses Association, that come and make and negotiate directly with the legislature for these things to some degree of success or less success.
So, Madam Chair, the proof is in the pudding. We're at 45% of market rate. Where wages are flat or decreasing. The providers' rates have been cut. Every county has its own licensing system. I mean, there's a lot of work that needs to be done, and the associations can still do all that work, and many people belong to both an association and belong to a union. So why not allow that option? All we're saying is allow the option. Right now under PELRA, they can't organize. Let's just take away that barrier and let them try.
Well, I think that's right. That is the question, and that's what I'm trying to get at. I like a 360-degree view of this. So what is the answer to why not? I mean, the testifiers are talking about why we should, the positive outcomes, but I need to understand, and I think our committee members want to understand, what it is that we risk in the process. And then if we want to vote for it, be willing to take that risk. I am asking, and I'm believing, based on what I've heard, that there is a risk that the boundaries that we establish on our budget will create an outcome that, if negotiations are successful for wage increases, that it will reduce the number of families that are served. And I haven't been persuaded that that isn't true. It doesn't mean I won't vote for it or not vote for it, but I really need to, and I hope every member of this committee cares to understand the consequences of what it is, potential negative consequences of what we might be doing here. Is there anyone else that would like? Yes.
Madam Chair, I just want to make a comment, and that is there's also risk if we do nothing. If we do nothing and we lose home care workers, for example, home care workers no longer want to do this work because the wages are so low and there's no benefits and there's no training, then we lose that risk of not having that workforce available to take care of our elderly. If we don't adequately reimburse providers, not only are we at risk of some, it's true, some may decide not to take child care subsidy because they don't like unions. Some may decide not to take child care subsidy because the reimbursement rates are so low they can't afford to do it. So, and that's another risk. Or it could just destabilize their clientele to such an extent that they can't survive, they can't make it, and they leave the business.
Which gets me to my second question. I think you were going to take a shot at that, which was on the CCAP program, when the rate is established, can, if a family has resources, they supplement that when they negotiate for a child care provider? Or are they to remain within the rate that's established for that program?
Madam Chair, providers can charge over the CCAP rate, but Many of them don't. I mean, I heard testimony in my committee that they know that parents can't afford to pay more based on their own wages that they're making. And so they will often just swallow the difference, and that really does drive down their per hour that they're making to be, as I mentioned earlier, under $5 an hour in the metro area and under $3 an hour in rural Minnesota.
So the probability is low that, but there could be a disparity between those who could pay a little extra than those who can't. Is that correct? And then I had another question right along that line that I've forgotten. So perhaps there's somebody else who has a question they'd like to ask. Did you pointed to somebody, Senator Nino?
Oh, I thought Senator Rosen was saying she had a question. I was going to say you can go.
Sure. Senator Nino.
Well, Madam Chair, I have a lot of questions, but I think maybe I do have a couple of amendments that I'll offer, but I'll hold off on those in case anyone else does have any questions they want to ask first, Madam Chair.
Excuse me, Senator Nino. Yeah.
I think I'm going to hold off on all my various questions and save them for some amendments that I have prepared to offer later, but if I'll hold off on those in case there's others that may want to ask questions at this time.
Are there other further questions? Okay, thank you. Then let's proceed. If there's some amendments, we have...
Madam Chair?
Yes.
My first amendment is an oral amendment. I didn't have it prepared ahead of time, but based on some of the answers that Senator Pappas gave, specifically to Senator Rosen in their exchange about Greater Minnesota and losing coverage for daycare services for families and such, Senator Pappas had talked about they only would be joining the union or having to pay fair share if a majority of the members wanted to have that possibility. To that end, I think the bill is out of line with certainly that answer and possibly the intent of Senator Pappas. I will move on line 3.7 and line 6.14. There's a 30% threshold. I will move to strike 30 and insert 50.01. And to that amendment, Madam Chair, that complies with the answers that we've been receiving and been hearing from Senator Pappas, that the intent of this legislation is if a majority of the daycare providers want to form a union, her intent is let's give them that vehicle. That amendment would do just that. It would say if a majority vote for it, then that's what they can do.
Okay. just a moment. Let's make sure we understand that on line 3.7,
yes.
You eliminate the number 30 and replace it with 50.01. Thank you. And then I guess that has to also be included on 6.14 because it's referred to again if that's in your amendment. Senator Pappas?
Madam Chair, I would ask committee members to vote against the amendment. This 50% is in the PELRA law, which is referenced at, I believe, in 3.12. It's in statute 179A. And how this would work is that if you wanted to be the exclusive representative, first of all, you'd have to get 500 names of people who say they support the union, and that would give you access to the lists. The list of the 9,000 daycare providers and the 11,000, 13,000 PCA people that are potentially part of the bargaining unit. That's 500. Then, working off that list, you would have to have 30% of that list. That's the 30% referenced on 3.7 before you can go to an election. Right? And then at the election of a mail ballot, you would have to have 50% and 1 of those people who vote that say they want to go toward, they want to have the union. So this 30% is just step two. The final step is 50%.
Senator Nino.
This is consistent with what we do in other union situations with PELRA.
Well, Senator Nino.
Madam Chair, I think if my amendment is adopted, I'll save you a step. But also, PELRA, I understand that this is standard, if you will, for PELRA. But the PELRA is an acronym. It's the Public Employment Labor Relations Act. These are not employees. This is a whole different animal. These are small business owners. And I do think we should have a different threshold when we're talking about small business owners. Typically, sole proprietorships, some of them may be incorporated LLCs and what have you, but we're not talking about 300 employees at a machine shop that maybe a number of them are afraid to sign a petition because they're afraid of what the boss is going to do. And you know, I can see we have a lower threshold in that environment because it can be a little more, for lack of a better word, threatening. But these are independently owned businesses. They report to themselves. There's no one that's going to threaten them with losing their business because they signed on to have a vote for a union. I think it's reasonable that we just out of the chute, can we get 50% or can't we? If we can't, then why even go to the election? And if you can, it's a done deal. I think it's reasonable, and you know, I hope members would support it.
Senator Pappas, just for clarity, because I really want people to understand what they're voting on, the 30% is of the 9,000 first of all, is it separated 50% of the licensed child care providers and 50% of the long-term care providers? Are those separated, or is it an accumulated group that you have to get 30% of the signatures for?
Madam Chair, they're totally separate.
Okay, and then the 50% threshold, that is 50% of those who vote. It's not necessarily 50% of the 9,000 or whatever the number is. So it's not 50% really of the providers. It's 50% of those who vote.
Madam Chair,
to be absolutely clear.
And that's true in any election in a democracy. Senator, I just wanted to respond to Senator Nino. Actually, this is a really higher bar for the unions to reach than if it was just one large workplace. One large workplace, you know, you can have a meeting, people come to the meeting, they talk to each other, they're much more accessible. These are workers who are scattered all over the state, and it's very labor-intensive to call, to email, to knock on someone's door, hopefully when the children are napping, not disturb them. You know, and they may say, I can't talk to you now, I'm too busy, so come back another day. And they have to do that. They want to get that person's support, because we've heard stories of where some people have been overly aggressive or rude, and they just turn the provider off then. So people have to be considerate and polite, or they're just not going to get any support. The same thing with the PCAs. They work all hours of the day. You don't know if there are more than one in the building that you may be in, a senior high-rise or something. So it's going to be very, very difficult for them to actually organize. And the 30% is a very – that's the PELRA statute. That's the standard, but it's a very difficult standard for these groups.
Senator Nino, Senator Marty, did you look?
Madam Chair,
I'm just going to make sure I know who all wants to ask a question. Senator Nino, I'll follow up, and then we should take an action on this amendment.
Madam Chair, roll call.
Roll call has been requested.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Pappas is making the flip side argument for why this makes sense up front. Because this is not a shop. We don't have 1,000 employees or 9,000 employees coming in voting over the course of a day or two or whatever the situation might be. They have to go out of their way to, number one, be aware that a vote is taking place and when and what the time frames are and the rules for replying. And number two, then they have to remember these are people that are running small businesses. And the final vote is not a majority of the pool. It's a majority of those that vote. And so I think because this is such a unique circumstance, we don't have employees coming into the shop or into the office who have been told every day for the last 30 days, hey, we're voting on the third of the month or whatever the case might be. These are people that are small business owners, typically women when you're talking about the daycare portion of it, spread all across the state, and as Senator Rosen rightly pointed out, often very remotely, far away from the next town or city. And they, quite honestly, might not be aware that the vote is coming up. They might not be aware of when the vote is coming up. They might not be aware of what the rules and the parameters are for responding, where to send it to, et cetera. I think it's reasonable that if we're going to ask independent small business owners to unionize, that we do create the little higher threshold up front. And if you get there, great. But what I would worry about is getting a 10% response rate, and getting 50.1% of 10%, because that's very possible in this circumstance.
Senator, was it Senator Benson next? I think I'll go with Senator Benson, then over to...
Mine was a request for roll call, Madam.
Okay, thank you. And Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, I was just going to say that I think I wonder, Senator Nino, are you proposing they have to meet 50% signatures and then a 50% vote, or were you proposing to eliminate the vote? I mean, you said you were going to save her a step. That's why I wondered if that was the intent of the legislation.
Senator Nino.
Senator Sharon, I think that would... this my oral amendment doesn't specify that, but I think that would essentially be the case. You would have your votes in hand already.
On the amendment, all those... it's a roll call. Would you please call the roll?
Senator Benson?
Aye.
Senator Eaton?
No.
Senator Hayden?
No.
Senator Hoffman?
No.
Senator Marty?
No.
Senator Nelson?
Yes.
Senator Nino?
Yes.
Senator Rosen?
Aye.
Senator Sharon?
No.
Senator Wicklin?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any further amendments?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Motion failed. Excuse me.
Madam Chair, I have the A40 amendment. We're going to be distributing lists, and lists are clearly under the jurisdiction of this committee. The A40 amendment requires that if someone's name is sent to an employee organizing organization, they must receive notice from the department that their name has been sent to that organization. And I'd request a roll call on this as well.
Excuse me, I didn't hear you, Senator Benson.
I'd request a roll call as well.
Another roll call has been requested. And Senator Pappas has received the amendment. You want a few seconds to have a look at it? And
you haven't seen it yet.
It's just my assistant note.
Requires a notice. Senator Pappas, did you want to speak to the amendment?
You're already in love.
Madam Chair, just from the PCAs, maybe I'll just let Mr. Zaffron respond.
Would you introduce yourself?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, David Zaffron with SEIU Healthcare. This just seems to be adding an unnecessary cost to this legislation.
They're already listed.
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, if the department has email could be communicated. It doesn't say that it has to be mailed. It could be email. And certainly if the department has enough resources to send a list to an employee organization, the people on that list certainly have the right to be notified that their name has been shared with an organization outside the Department of Human Services.
Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the question I have is a process question, and I don't know if there's someone from the department that can speak to it. I guess I would like to know the process of getting on the list and what do the the folks that constitute the list, do they know that they're on the list? And what? How does DHS interact with them now? I think that that would help me understand the amendment.
On page
Senator Benson
2, line 21, compilation of the list describes how you get on the list. And then starting with line 30 on page 2, talks about list access. And so it's not interfering with the lists that are being requested by these organizations. It's simply saying if you're on a list and it's sent to someone outside the department, you have a right to know that your information was sent outside the department.
So, Senator Hayden, I think the answer to your question is that you get on the list by accepting payment for child care assistance services within 6 months.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess the question is, does when the person gets on the list, do they is the list then deemed exclusive, or is the list public information? That's so to Senator Benson, I read that part of it. I'm just trying to get the practical application of what when someone gets on the list, how do they think the information is being used? And if that information is public, then it seems that Senator Benson's amendment is moot. But that's what I'm trying to find
Senator
out.
Senator Benson?
And Madam Chair and Senator Hayden, if the information's public, then the department doesn't have to compile it. The organizing units can do it themselves.
Well, Senator Benson, Madam Chair, that's why I wanted to not have a rhetorical conversation with you and see if there was someone in the department that can answer my question.
Is there anyone from DHS that would be willing to articulate how this data would be treated?
Madam Chair, I'm trying to understand to what Senator Benson's purpose is here.
Senator Benson?
Madam Chair, it's so that the child care providers know that their name is being sent to this specific organization. If the department, and I am not suggesting this, decided to share it with a toy manufacturer or a crib company, I would expect the same courtesy, but that issue is not here before us at this point. The department is being asked to compile a list for a very specific purpose and to make that information available. And I think it's only fair that the provider know that their name is being shared for a specific purpose. It's not just public information that I can scroll through. I, as a citizen, can look up who are licensed providers. It is being compiled for a specific purpose.
Thank you. From the department?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mary Orr. I work for the Department of Human Services and oversee the Child Care Assistance Program. The names of child care providers, whether they're licensed or unlicensed, if they're registered to participate in the Child Care Assistance Program, that is public information, and upon request, we do make that information available.
Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just speak in favor of the amendment. I think this is eminently reasonable, and let me tell you why. We're talking about daycare providers, many of whom, I know a lot of people that provide daycare, many of whom operate this out of their home. And absolutely, I would expect that union representatives would be coming and knocking on the door. We've heard testimony in the past. That's what they did when they were getting cards signed. And it can be, and most of these programs are run by women who are there, oftentimes just themselves and the children at home. And if you are in a situation like that, you've got 3, 4, 5 children, whatever you might have, you're there in charge of them. You are entrusted with their safety. And some strange person is knocking on your door, it could be very, very disconcerting. At least with this proposal, they will know that that's probably coming. And it will make sense to them when this person knocks on the door and says, hello, I'm with XYZ union, and we're following up now on this unionization request. Let me tell you why it's a good idea, et cetera, et cetera. If they're not aware that that's going to be happening and someone shows up at their door, they are going to be very skeptical and probably a little worried. Who knows? They might even call the cops because they're going to be thinking, I'm running a small business. Why on earth would anyone think I'm going to join a union? It just would be odd unless they've got a heads up. So I think this is a reasonable request.
Madam Chair, to that point, so I'm trying to follow what the department said is, one, the information is public, and upon request, they can have it, right? Anybody, right? Number two, I was following Senator Nenow's rationale, which is to say that unions had already been around knocking on doors to get the card requests. So one, the information is public. Two, unions had already been around talking to them about this proposal. Three, we have a room full of people on both sides that seem to be very well informed about this issue. So from my perspective, to follow this logic, it appears that the only thing that this really does is just cost us more money, but it really is not a real rationale, a sound rationale, in my opinion, for us to add more money or more cost to this, because people know that it's already coming. And in fact, many people have already had their doors knocked on to see if they were even interested in this in the first place.
Senator Nelson, to this amendment?
Yes, I do have a question to this amendment. Ms. Orr, and it kind of delves into what Senator Hayden was saying. So what are the guidelines for distributing this information? If I, let's say I'm an insurance agent and I have one of the few policies that has specific category to provide liability for daycare providers. Could I request a list of all the daycare providers in the state so that I can target them with my insurance policy that has this particular endorsement that no other company has?
Ms. Orr.
Madam Chair, Senator, I don't know that we have received a request like that before. But when we have received requests for registered providers, we have been basically provided the list because it is allowed under state law.
Senator Nelson.
Madam Chair, and this is not necessarily the Health Committee. I think there definitely needs to be some guidelines around that. I'm very uncomfortable thinking that marketers or anyone else can use our state resources to compile marketing lists. I think there needs to be some, and we can address that later, and that's not part of Senator Pappas's bill, but I think that's a very worrisome practice, and I'd encourage some oversight of that.
And I can assure you that when lists or data is collected or distributed, the judiciary, where the issue of data collection and protection is very closely scrutinized. So there's another place where that is clearly within their authority.
Madam Chair, will this be going to the Judiciary Committee then?
Yes,
all right,
it is.
Thank you very much.
And then Senator Hayden, Senator Nelson.
And then, Madam Chair, quickly, I think that's sometimes the confusion in this bill, that we kind of are dealing with kind of two separate entities. So can Mr. Zaffron comment that if the policy of DHS for daycare workers is the same that you've experienced for PCA workers?
Madam Chair, Senator Hayden, to my knowledge, no, it is not the same, and that this information is not available publicly as it is with child care providers.
The PCA DHS person is here. Could you come forward? I think it's really important for us to get the information from the department on this issue. And you're here to answer Senator Hayden's question about the difference about how the data is treated.
Madam Chair, Senator Hayden, my name is Alex Bartolik, and I'm with the Department of Human Services. It is different for personal care. We would treat it as a data request. We would only make available public information, the name of the person. For the most part, these are employees. This is not an independent provider. So these are employees of a fiscal intermediary agency or PCA Choice or a PCA agency. We would probably have to do a little bit of work to make sure we know who's working under PCA Choice versus regular PCA. And the bill also includes other entities such as people who are hired through the consumer-directed community supports. And we don't have a registry of those individuals. We would have to go to the fiscal support entities who pay their bills to get the information.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Hayden.
So I'm sorry, I missed your name. So would the folks that we're asking the information from, the PCA, you know, self-directed PCA folks, would they know that someone was asking for their information as part of the information request?
Senator Hayden, are you asking, would the person know that their name may be given to a variety of sources? Is that what you're asking?
Madam Chair, that is what I'm attempting to ask.
Madam Chair, not necessarily. We would have to notify them.
Are you required to notify them?
Madam Chair, I don't believe so.
Okay, thank you. Any further discussion on this amendment?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure if this is a good idea, if it's necessary. I know it's it may not necessarily be in place now, and it could be costly. And we probably would have to get a fiscal note on it and deal with it in Finance Committee. I would like to say, though, that the union protocol is to send a postcard out to the person letting them know that they're coming or they're going to be calling for an appointment and that they show up with a badge that identifies who they are. So they don't just they don't just show up at their door randomly, because that's not good. It's just not a good thing to do if you're trying to organize people.
Yeah, I think that the amendment in front of us, though, is once the list is developed and there's a request for that list, what are the parameters around the list? So, Senator Rosen, did you
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, just a couple things, and we're going to deal with how a union is organized, because that there has been discrepancy on how it should happen and what has happened. But actually, I don't really understand why we have to have the A40 amendment if we just raise the CCAP and payments and adjusted the PCA payments going forward. We'd be fine. There is no reason why these folks need to be unionized, because it keeps going back to what's going to happen when they do have to pay a fair share or their union dues per month. They're going to have to get another person, another baby, another child. And they're going to be stressed in the licensed daycare provider, and then in the PCA they may have to put them into a traditional setting, which is going to be very costly to the state because of these ramifications. And we don't know exactly how much it's going to cost per month, and that's the unknown. So I think if we want to just take care of this whole situation, I have heard testimony saying that it's all because of what's happened in the last 2 years that this is going to happen. Well, then let's just talk about increasing the rates, the CCAP rates, and be done with it.
Thank you, Senator Rosen. This is to the amendment about the data. Senator Nienau, I would like you to know, I don't know how many other amendments there are here, but we're scheduled, before we go on, scheduled at 2:30. If we do not finish this, we will be taking it up at the end of tonight's session, because we will be staying at this until we resolve the issue. So I don't know how much more conversation there will be now, but it will continue this evening.
If the committee wants to put this amendment on, we can talk about it more in judiciary, so we don't have to.
So let's proceed, Senator Nienau, and then we're going to move towards action.
Well, Madam Chair, at your discretion, I did have an additional question I had for the department, and now might be apropos. Based on the comments that this could have a fiscal impact, we need a fiscal note, et cetera. I did have a question relative to several provisions in the bill and whether the department is willing to testify that will not cause them additional cost. If you'd like me to ask that question now, we could bring them up, or I could wait till later.
Is it in relationship to the general overall cost of the total bill or this specific amendment?
Well, the general bill, but in the context of one of the points of opposition is that it might have a fiscal impact.
Madam
if there's
Chair,
other provisions.
I just said I support the amendment, so if you want to just put it on.
I'll ask the question later, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. So seeing no further discussion, this a roll call has been requested on the A40 amendment. Senator Benson asked for a roll call.
I did, yes. Senator Benson?
Aye.
Senator Eaton?
No.
Senator Hayden?
Aye.
Senator Hoffman?
Aye.
Senator Marty?
Aye.
Senator Nelson?
Aye.
Senator Nienau?
Yes.
Senator Sharon?
Aye.
Senator Rosen?
Aye.
Senator Wicklin?
Yes.
The motion passes.
Madam Chair.
Or the amendment passes. Excuse me. Just a moment. Okay. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have the A31 amendment. Members, this is a very short amendment, but basically it limits the scope of this bill to licensed providers. And just while we're on that discussion, I will say that the A32 does the same thing. It's just in a different part of the bill. So this is the A31.
Senator Nelson moves the A31 amendment.
And I'll call for a roll call.
Call for a roll call. You've described what's in the amendment.
Oh, it's very simple.
I'm sorry. Yes. I didn't know you were waiting for me. I thought you were waiting for the bill to be passed out. Madam Chair, I would oppose the amendment and ask the committee to vote it down. It appears that there is an attempt to create kind of two classes of family daycare providers. And I think that they have more in common than they do not. And I don't think we should separate them out. So I would urge members to vote no on the A.
Madam Chair?
Senator Nelson.
Well, there are two categories. There's licensed and unlicensed. That's clearly within our current situation, and there's a great difference between the number of licensed and unlicensed providers. And I would submit that unlicensed providers are unlicensed for a reason. They don't want the interference with the government or some other entity. And so I would suggest, since this bill has to do with government-provided subsidies, that it be limited to those who have signed up with the licensed providers.
Senator Pappas.
Chair, Senator Nelson, if unlicensed providers don't want the interference from the government, then why would they take CCAP? Isn't that government? I mean, it seems to me that unlicensed providers, they are just as important to our children as licensed providers, and they need our help in preparing children for school and having access to training. And because they are accepting subsidy rates, we do have a vested interest in making sure that the care they're giving is high-quality care, even if they have a limited number of students, of young people, and decide not to be licensed. So I don't think that we should have two tiers here. I think they need to be kept together.
Senator Nelson and then Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Pappas. Well, I agree with you as far as high-quality care. And certainly I offered an amendment in education today, which maybe I should bring to this bill as well, which would require that all CCAP dollars be tied to parent aware. That is what we're talking about, high quality early childhood tied to outcomes and results. And in fact, maybe I can have our reviser prepare that. I'll offer that amendment as well here. So if we're concerned about quality, and we all are, then we should the $400 million a biennium that we're spending on child care assistance programs should be tied to quality. I know there's a time where the systems need to ramp up, and so I'll talk about that when my amendment comes. But for right now, I would ask for a yes vote on the A31, which is limiting this bill to licensed providers.
Senator Benson?
Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, an unlicensed provider might be a sister-in-law who's taking care of their niece or nephew who also happens to get CCAP as a benefit, and they're not doing it because they want the government money. They're doing it because they want to take care of their niece or nephew, and that family happens to fall in a category that qualifies them for CCAP. It has nothing to do with the quality of their care. There's a different quality that comes from that relationship that the parents are determining. And I don't know that we need the government telling those parents, I'm sorry, you're just not smart enough to figure this out. We'll tell you how you're going to take care of your kids. So, let's limit this to those who have decided to go forward with licensure, who are stepping into a bigger category, and take the licensed providers out.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I've got a number of questions about the bill and the process about it, but I really bothered by some of the discussion of unlicensed people just being family members. There are an awful lot of unlicensed providers who are, it's very difficult to get licensure, and a lot of stuff they have to go through, and we've been watching over the years how the department tries to bring more people into licensure because of the benefits, the safety and other things. But I really think, I mean, if one's to go ahead with something like this where you're trying to tie it to the child care subsidy, which is a large amount of money, and I understand, I mean, I think that the chair raised some good points earlier, but in terms of trying to get funding for that, I can see why people may want to organize that way. And the distinction between licensed and unlicensed, I've just bothered reading a lot of the letters and everything else about the putting down people who are unlicensed as if they either are unsafe or don't care, or they're all family members, which you're saying, which some of them are. But I don't see the distinction here for the purposes of this bill. Again, I have questions about the bill, but I'm not sure why this distinction would be the one to make.
Senator Eaton.
Senator Marty made my point. Thank you.
Seeing no further discussion on the A31 amendment, a roll call has been was a roll call requested?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Senator Benson?
Aye.
Senator Eaton?
No.
Senator Hayden?
No.
Senator Hoffman?
No.
Senator Marty?
No.
Senator Nelson?
Aye.
Senator Nienow?
Yes.
Senator Rosen?
Aye.
Senator Wicklund?
No.
Senator Sharon?
Aye. Yeah, the vote is tied. The motion fails on a tie.
Madam Chair, at this time, might I offer the A32?
The A32 amendment?
And again, this one relates to the list that is described on page 3. And so those who would be on the list, should the A32 amendment be adopted, would be those who are licensed or are caring for a child receiving child care assistance at the time. So it limits the scope of who's on the list. And I think it gets to Senator Pappas's concern. Oh, actually, excuse me, it strikes on a monthly list. So this amendment would replace those who are on the list with those who are licensed or who are caring for a child that's receiving child care assistance. So it does limit the scope.
Senator Pappas, are you prepared to?
Madam Chair, I'm trying to understand.
What?
Just what?
Oh, I see what it is.
So, I'm trying to understand the purpose of the amendment.
Yes. So, Madam Chair, shall
Senator
I read
Nelson?
It? Yeah, with the language, were it adopted, 3.8 would read, the family child care providers eligible to vote in any such election shall be those family child care providers who are licensed or are caring for a child receiving child care assistance at the time.
Madam Chair?
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, this did come up in my committee where some of the daycare providers who are licensed but don't take CCAP wanted to be able to vote in the election. And we said that doesn't make any sense because we're only talking about CCAP family providers. So if you never take CCAP, then it doesn't really impact you at all. So since this says licensed or... I assume it means you're eligible to vote even if you don't take CCAP. If it said licensed and, then it's leaving out the unlicensed people. So in either case, I would oppose the amendment.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. Senator Benson?
Madam Chair, doesn't this also cover 119B.03, which is the sliding fee? So it's not just CCAP. Am I correct? Maybe council can...
CCAP is the sliding fee.
Ms. White?
The sliding fee is
Madam Chair and members, yeah, basic sliding fee gets CCAP, and MFIP child care gets CCAP payments. So
okay, so CCAP covers sliding fee and MFIP. Are there any other categories? Because I apologize, Madam Chair, I'm asking for help from Council. We look at 119B.03, 0.05, and 0.011 in the initial amendment, and I just want to make sure I understand the categories.
And the last reference is to the transitional child care.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions, discussion?
I'll call for a roll call, please.
There's a roll call on the A32 amendment. Please take the roll.
Senator Benson?
Aye.
Senator Eaton?
No.
Senator Hayden?
No.
Senator Hoffman?
No.
Senator Marty? Senator Nelson?
Yes.
Senator Nienow?
Yes.
Senator Rosen?
Yes.
Senator Wicklund?
No.
Senator Sharon?
No. The amendment fails.
Madam Chair?
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have the A34 amendment.
Okay, thank you, Senator Rosen. We'll begin this. So we have about 5 minutes or so that we can introduce this, have some discussion, see where it goes, and then we will be recessing till this evening and picking this subject back up after we move through our regular agenda, if we're not through by the end of this amendment. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a real doable amendment. And basically, I think there was some talk today about some of the issues with the representatives coming to the door, knocking on the door. I received many comments from my district about how it was handled. Many comments just throughout the state. Some of them were rude. There was no identification. Were not able to really examine the card as well as they could, didn't understand the ramifications of the card. And you have to remember, members, these are independent small business owners that happen to be taking some state dollars for child subsidies or the PCAs. And I think this is a really valid amendment that says, it basically says the first subdivision 13, you will be a union worker on lines 1.6, and you'll be negotiating with MMB. And if on 1.7, if an exclusive representative is elected to represent family child care providers, you'll be paying the periodic dues or a fair share fee of up to 85%. So I think this is something about just being full disclosure and making sure that these folks know what they're are reading, what they're signing. It talks about in subdivision 13, the disclosure requirement ballot of 18-point font or larger that reads, for the purposes of Minnesota statutes, the state is a public employer. I think, it's very, I'm not quite sure why you have subdivision 13 several times there. But
Ms. White?
Ms. White, yeah, could you explain
subdivision 13's necessity?
Madam Chair and members, the first part of the amendment on page 4, which adds language to page 4, it looks as though it amends the child care, and then the second part amends the PCA portion of the bill.
And Madam Chair and Ms. White, there's two subdivision 13s on page 4, so perhaps that's just a typo.
Oh, goodness. Yes. We need to make... Yes, Madam Chair... That's a technical amendment. I can make sure the subdivisions are numbered correctly.
Okay. So, Madam Chair and members, I think this is just basically full disclosure of what you're signing. Make sure that it's legible. I didn't go into proper identification of the people that are showing up at the door. We certainly can. But I think this is something that everybody should know what they are, the card they're signing.
Senator Pappas, did you have a chance to review this?
Yes, Madam Chair. We saw this amendment in the previous committee as well, and it's actually duplicative. These are already governed by both the Bureau of Mediation and by Management and Budget. They prepare the ballot. They hire a third party. It's already governed by the PELRA statutes. So it really is unnecessary to do this and duplicative.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Perhaps it is, but then perhaps I'd like to know why it was not followed and it was not followed, and the cards that were at the door were not 18 font.
Apparently, Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, we haven't had an election. So.
Senator Rosen.
What do you mean?
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, and Senator Rosen, perhaps you can help me understand this, but it's my understanding the first part of each of these sections has to do with as they go door to door collecting signatures, not for ballots. So the information on the signature card appears to me substantially similar to the information on the ballot, so that the person at the door could be fully informed before they apply their signature.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Just so you know what happens in reality, these are the cards that are people sign at the door for the 30%. To reach the 30% threshold, and maybe the page could come and get these and pass them around.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas, if this were to pass, it wouldn't conflict with what you're saying on the cards, correct? So.
I really don't know for sure, Madam Chair, because we'd have to look at the... starting both ways. We'd have to look at the PELRA chapters, and we'd have to look at what was in place already to see if the language conflicts with existing law. So it's that's why we have PELRA. It lays out the whole process. MMB has done this before. They have a process. They hire a third party to make sure that the election is fair and unbiased, and all these things are already in place.
Senator Nino, is there anybody here from the department that can answer this question?
Thank you.
At this time? Senator Nino?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I'll reiterate, PELRA is Public Employment Labor Relations Act. These are not employees. These are small business owners. And so circumstances are going to be different. But my question for the author of the bill is, if this is all outlined in PELRA or some other statute or some department rule, what are the protocols that are outlined? What is required to be disclosed? What language, what question, what format?
I asked to see if anybody could answer the question. It didn't appear there was anyone here. So because of the time, I think we will table this amendment. And ask Senator Pappas or ask the department to provide us information this evening to answer the questions that have been asked by the committee members. And with that, we'll recess until 6 o'clock in room 15.